will make some funny twangy noise in a minute, and I have to go over and dope slap it into submission. Respiratory diseases, respiratory system suffers from all the kinds of diseases and processes that we've talked about, or you've talked about in other systems so far. So the way in which I'm going to go through this isn't going to change to any great extent. Clinical symptoms, however, are quite a bit different depending on common things such as smoking history and things like that. We're going to spend some time talking about a great category, large category disease we call chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, of which there are two basic divisions. One is emphysema and the other is chronic bronchitis. The emphysema thing is something that we're all going to have to some degree as we get older. We all lose pulmonary capacity. We all lose that exchange surface area just from breathing. Oxygen, as you probably know, is a highly reactive molecule, and it actually does damage to our lung tissue. And in time, we lose some. We lose little bits and pieces of it. So the amount of lung tissue that we have, that I have, is not what I started out with at all, not like what you have. But okay. So there's just some age-related changes here. One of the things that we'll look at is that because of this junk suspended in the air, whether it's particulate matter or part of the atmosphere itself, things can have ozone and other sorts of things can have a pretty detrimental effect on pulmonary tissue. And one of the first things that you look at here, you might think about, we think about the pulmonary system, we of course immediately start going to the alveolus or something like that. But remember that the respiratory system begins all the way up here. Our sinuses are included, the nose is included. And in terms of just basic protection, we have among other things, nose hairs, my favorite kind of protection. They're nose hairs. And they filter out a lot of particulates. And if you don't have nose hairs, and there are people who are born without those, that you have a much greater incidence of pulmonary infections and things. Bacteria and stuff ride in on that particulate matter. And particulate matter that's quite small can get out into the alveolar spaces and stay there and do a lot of chronic injury. Just the presence of them alone can lead to an ongoing chronic inflammatory process. So when we think about respiratory system, I'm going to start all the way out here. In terms of, again, protective measures, the cilia are involved. We make mucin. All of us, you may not be aware of it, but you sort of clear your throat now and again as the mucin is produced in the airways is used to trap particulates and stuff. And then it gets whisked along by the cilia, brought back up. You clear your throat. What you're doing is you're bringing up some of that mucus and you're swallowing it. And so a lot of this stuff is designed basically to prevent any kind of particulates getting in, either infection or the chronic injury of the particulates. Cough reflex, that sort of business. I'm sure you've all aspirated something or other, you know, and then you start coughing and hacking until you bring it all up. And sometimes that will trigger quite a release of mucin for a period of time, and you will have, you may cough for a good little bit. And so our last protective measure in terms of certainly infectious diseases, but also a potential problem in terms of ongoing chronic injury is our immune system. And the immune system really is coasting to some extent here because of all these other things that are work to protect us from particulates in the air and infectious diseases that are on those particulates and so on. We think about the functions, as I'm sure you are now aware, functions of the lung. One is, of course, exchange gas. That's a principal thing, which means not only bring in oxygen, but also blow off CO2. So by extension, then, it's very much involved in pH management, just as the kidney is involved. It might have other functions, enterologic functions, that we just are starting to learn about. And it's very possible that it also indirectly sieves out small blood clots and garbage that would be circulating in the blood, and so that they don't end up on the arterial side of the circulation. I mean, the main thing, of course, is gas exchange and pH management. If we get down into the lung, this is where most people, where we kind of go right off the bat, and that is what's going on in the alveolus. We'll take a quick peek at that, but we're going to then back right back out and look at the lung as a whole, and eventually the bronchi and so forth. So this is obviously a very high power sort of stylized sketch of a capillary, basement membrane and alveolar space with type 2 alveoli, type 2 epithelial cells here that are producing the surfactant that keeps the alveolus from you know, collapsing on itself and not being able to expand. As I'm sure you're aware now, this basement membrane in here is pretty critical that it's nice and thin, because as you increase the size of that, the capacity to move gas across it drops by the square of the distance. And so if you double the distance of the basement membrane here, say through edema, fluid, inflammatory cells or something, you drop the ability to move gas by 4. So it's a pretty substantial change, and this thing is pretty well tuned to this kind of to that architecture right there. So we'll be taking a look at, in a little bit, some of the changes that go on down there with infection or chronic injury. And as I mentioned, the base, the lung and respiratory tree from sinuses and nose all the way down to the alveoli suffer from the same sort of infection, same sort of diseases or injury that every other system does. There are congenital anomalies, and I want to say a few words about that, things that you're born with, either developmental or genetic, such as alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency or cystic fibrosis, which is the most common inherited genetic disease, by the way. Infections, you might be surprised to know how much air we move. Maybe you already do know, but on the average, we move around 10,000 liters. That was 10,000 liters of air a day. So you're moving a lot of air in and out all the time. So if there are things suspended in the air or gases in there that are going to do damage, you get quite a bit of exposure to it. If that includes particulates that have infectious agents on it or droplets in the air that are infected, potentially infectious, you're going to come down with it. Neoplastic stuff, true tumors, are not rare at all, of course, and they're largely related to cigarette smoking. We'll talk about that and what we do to ourselves there. Nutritional things, I'll have to think, I assume vitamin C or something, I have to come up with something there, I guess. Trauma, we're going to talk a little bit about trauma. Immunologic injury is very important in the lung, particularly where we end up with either an antigen-antibody problem, similar to what we talked about in the case of the kidney, or just the chronic immunologic stimulus or stimulus to the immune system of having a particle down there that in and of itself is completely inert. And we'll look at vascular abnormalities, and particularly an infection by a particular variety of herpes that leads to tremendous vascular changes, and basically a person will die with inability of blood to flow through the lungs. Well, here is something that is developmental, and there's not linked to any particular gene, and this is a problem of development of the lung. The diaphragm, as you know, is involved in motion and expanding the chest space so that we can take in, we can inhale, we can take in a breath. And it divides the abdominal cavity and the thoracic cavity. It's a continuous sheet of muscle. It's pretty darn thin, actually. It's only a few millimeters in thickness, but it is continuous without any holes in it, most of us. If it does have a hole in it developmentally, it is possible that the GI tract, part of the GI tract, will replace or displace itself up into the thoracic cavity. Lungs are going to have a need space to develop. And if the GI tract comes up through one of these holes right through here, diaphragmatic hernia as it's called, and then the GI tract is up there, that lung cannot develop. Now, you probably know that an adult can get by, I would say they can get by fine, and that could be terribly active, but they can get by fine on one lung. If for whatever reason, say traumatic injury, or for some reason you had to have a lung removed, you'd do okay with it. You wouldn't actually be out running road races again, but you'd do okay. That's not the case for an infant. A newborn infant requires 2 lungs totally. You got to have that amount of surface space working for you, or that kid is not going to live. It cannot go on one lung. By the time you're through puberty and growth and all that sort of business, you can get by on one lung. We do pneumonectomies all the time for cancer and other sorts of things, but not a newborn. And so if because of a diaphragmatic hernia and the GI tract is up here developmentally in utero, that lung is not going to develop. That kid is not going to have a snowball's chance. It will not live 1 minute. Now, it's actually, it's a challenging fix, but it's done with some regularity. Quality ultrasounds, neonatal ultrasounds, will show that there is something wrong here, and people actually do intrauterine surgery. You can go in, pull the GI tract essentially down here and close that sucker off, and if you do that early enough, that lung will develop appropriately. It's an amazing sort of thing that can actually do that in utero, but they do. So what you have is a hypoplastic lung as a consequence, essentially, of it simply can't develop because there's no room in that part of the chest. And without two lungs, that kid is not going to live. So that's a developmental kind of thing. Now, in terms of gene-related things, we can point to specific genes. The cystic fibrosis and alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency are the most significant thing. Secondarily would be immune system failure, and by that I mean where you have a developmental anomaly that you don't have, you make B cells or something like that. Well, in that case, you're getting infections all over the place, not just in the lungs. In the case of cystic fibrosis, as you're probably aware, this is a ion channel defect. And what happens is that in the case of the mucus that you normally produce for the lungs in the alveolus, or not the alveolus rather, but in the bronchi, and you coat that the bronchial wall with mucus, you know, the air doesn't come in there. It doesn't flow in a laminar pattern. In fact, things are designed to make the air agitate, to make it kind of turbulent as it's moving. All the way up here, you've got special bones in your nose to set up, you know, the turbulence. And the idea is you want the air kind of rolling along as it comes in through the down through the bronchi, the trachea and the bronchi, and you want it to roll along in a way rather than be linear, because that basically increases the chances that particulates are going to come in contact with the mucus. Well, the mucus is produced in a very thick and tenacious kind of way, a form, and it is basically pooped out onto the surface of the bronchus, the bronchial mucosa, and then it hydrates, and it hydrates things basically to the number of ions that it gets in there, calcium and so forth. And when we screw that ability up, you end up with this very thick, gooey mucus that never gets thin and kind of, you know, liquefied. And basically serves as a plug. As it accumulates, it will plug up the airways. It'll also plug up the pancreatic duct. And one thing that we will see with children who have that is that they basically digest their own pancreas because of these plugs that occur from that mucus. And so the person with cystic fibrosis has basically several problems. One with pulmonary system because of recurrent infections. And the infections occur because they simply have all these plugs in the system. Your airway is not sterile. I mean, even though it does a good job of scrubbing out particulates and things like that, that air is not sterile. It goes all the way down to the alveoli. And so if there is a chance that bacterial growth can start to occur that you can't cough up or the cilia can't sweep up, then it's going to get going, and it's going to actually begin to proliferate to the point where it involves large portions of the lung. And that's what happens with cystic fibrosis, is you basically have these mucus plugs because they don't hydrate properly. Well, the same thing's going on in the pancreas. So kids who have cystic fibrosis, typically by the time they're teenagers, they got no pancreas left, which means they can't absorb fats with a crap. So they can't absorb vitamins, the fat-soluble vitamins, K, A, D, and E. And so they have a number of problems related to that. But the problems in the pulmonary system will be recurrent infections. Alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency will lead to emphysema. We're going to talk about emphysema with respect to chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. In the case of emphysema, what's happening is that the person is destroying their own lung tissue. They're breaking it down, and you start to lose lung tissue at an accelerated rate. Now, how does alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency lead to that? We always have, you know, we're always having some level of injury or infection or something's going on, even stuff that you're not aware of. And so there's some activation of proteases and elastases all the time in every one of us, every single day, every minute. And these elastases and proteases that are going to are involved in removing damaged tissue wherever it occurs in your body. Imagine it's in your big toe, alrighty? Well, those elastases and proteases are involved in breaking down collagen and dead cells and so forth and removing that. And as long as they stay localized, as long as they stay at the point of injury, everything's just fine. And some of them spontaneously activate. They're circulating in the blood, let's say. Well, they should be contained with inflammatory cells, but some of them leak, some of them get out either at the point of injury. So I suppose some could get out with senescent dead cells, inflammatory cells. But in any event, the activated proteases that are circulating in the bloodstream are going to do damage essentially all over the body, but it's most evident in the lungs. Now, we have a system of digesting and removing those activated proteases. They can be broken down. There are specific cleavage spots in them such that the enzymes that break them down know where to go and start the process. The other thing that we do is we have proteins that are circulating in the blood to passively absorb them. They got receptors effectively on the surface of them, so that these activated proteases that are circulating to a small extent in all of us get absorbed onto these proteins, and then they're removed in the liver, the whole unit. And alpha-1 antitrypsin is one of those. Alpha-1 antitrypsin is out there. It actually involves, you can imagine, trypsin is one of the digestive enzymes. Perhaps you've heard about it with respect to actually used in GI absorption and so forth, but it absorbs a number of different activated proteases. And if you don't have enough of that, if you've got liver disease and you can't make that, or if you have inherited a gene in this particular case and you can't make it, and the gene, interestingly enough, does not typically, the most common form of this does not mean that there is absence of the gene that codes for alpha-1 antitrypsin. What's missing is a chaperone protein. The chaperone protein is involved in folding up the enzyme in the proper configuration. We touched upon this when we were talking about liver disease, and what's missing is a chaperone protein. So you can, most people who have this deficiency state, it means it's simply deficient in the circulating blood, and so it can't do its job. If it's missing in the circulating blood, all the passively activated or escaped proteases are going to damage tissue all over the place. But in the case of alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, the chaperone protein is botched up, so it can't fold up the protein, the enzyme, and it can't become hydrate or can't become carbohydrate bound as it should. In the case of the liver, that stuff accumulates in the liver cell. That's kind of like having a major phase of constipation and you feel real crappy, you know. In this case, the liver cell feels so crappy it dies. So you end up with liver cell injury. You also end up with pulmonary injury because the finished product is not in the circulating blood, cannot passively absorb the trypsins, activated alpha-1 trypsin, and other proteases as well. You know, what we have, every adult who has two lungs, basically at your age, fundamentally has roughly a football field of surface area in those two lungs. That's about it. That's a lot of surface area when you think about it. And what's happening is we're all losing a little bit of that every single day. We're doing that through oxidative damage and other sorts of things. We're losing that. You can accelerate that process. These people right here are really on the fast track. By the time they're in their late teens, early 20s, they're already on the 30-yard line, you know. They've already digested 70% of their lung tissue. And so they are really in a serious way. So they're basically just essentially losing it, losing the pulmonary tissue. We're going to talk in just a minute now about what we mean by obstructive pulmonary disease, of which emphysema is a version. And you might say, well, where does the obstruction come in? In emphysema, if you're simply destroying the lung. So it's actually a two-hit kind of phenomenon there. So those would be two common examples. Before we get to that, we're going to stay still with the overall structure of the lung and what are things that can impede pulmonary function. And what we're first going to look at will be sort of compression of the lung or collapse of the lung. The lung stays inflated basically by magic. It does. The lung is not in any way attached to, in fact, it's pathological to attach the lung to the pulm, to the chest wall. The lung itself moves in there completely. And what holds it out, what keeps it inflated, and when I take a breath, it moves with the wall, is quite simple. And that is simply the surface tension of the water between the chest wall itself and the surface of the lung. It's a little bit like if you took two glass slides, you know, microscopic slides. I don't recommend this, all right? Or if you do it, at least don't let Bagley see you do it. Take two glass slides and spit on one of them, all right? And stick those suckers together. Now you got a drop of water holding two glass slides together, right? How easy do you think it is to pull those apart? Not easy, let me tell you. Give it a try, okay? Just don't let her see you do it, all right? And you'll be surprised how much that drop of water is sufficient once it spreads out between those two slides to hold two glass slides together. And that's the only thing that keeps that lung inflated, is the fact that it is stuck there by surface tension. Now, a variety of things can change that, and if that's the case and the lung begins to compress itself, the alveolar spaces are also going to collapse, and that's referred to as atelectasis. Atelectasis is essentially the collapse of the alveolar spaces. Here's an example of a plug. This would be just a mucus plug. Now, this might be the case, of course, many times over in someone with cystic fibrosis. And so when you have a plug here and you can't aerate part of the lung, well, one of the interesting things will happen. Blood still flows through it, but you can't aerate it. And so first thing you do is the blood sucks out all the oxygen. And 80% of that atmosphere was still nitrogen in there, but guess what? Nitrogen will also displace and get pulled into the bloodstream. We boil it off by, we actually absorb a fair bit of nitrogen passively in the blood. There's no carrier mechanism for it, there like there is with oxygen, where it's bound to hemoglobin. But we pick up a lot of nitrogen. Guess where it goes? It boils off in our GI tract and becomes parts of our farts. Okay? Well, in this case, what happens is, if you can't aerate it, it may take a day or two, but eventually the blood is still flowing through that part of the lung. It sucks every bit of the gas out. Oxygen, nitrogen works, and the alveoli all collapse. And that collapse of the alveoli is called atelectasis. But you can imagine then, again, with no movement in here, if you had some a few bacteria back here, now they're kind of in hog heaven. They can start to proliferate. But this is showing a collapse of part of the lung, and it's separated from the chest wall simply because of a plug in there, and you pull the oxygen out. Here's compression, say, due to blood or fluid that's accumulating in there. And here's an interesting problem, something we will talk about that, and that is a lot of scarring within the lung, and the scar kind of contracts. And as the scar tissue over the years contracts, it sort of pulls the lung together from within. This is the kind of thing we actually see a fair bit here. We used to of people who work in the limestone industry, because they would get the limestone dust in their lungs, couldn't get it out, and the scarring that would result would lead to kind of collapse or contraction of the lung. So these are three things that can lead to kind of compression of the lung itself. Well, you can imagine if there's air in here, if someone put a knife in your chest, and air in here, as soon as the air starts to separate that, the lung is simply going to deflate. So, and if we have blood or something like that, the lung will deflate. So that's basically what's going to happen. The magic that holds that lung out there is by no means connective tissue or anything like that. It is purely surface tension, water surface tension. Let's take a look here at what we mean by obstructive and restrictive diseases of the lung. We just looked at an example of both of those. One obstruction was that plug. The other was the restriction of motion by the scar tissue. We're going to develop those ideas a little bit. We talked about obstructive conditions, and that will mean either maybe a plug, but also it may mean that the airways collapse on themselves. And that's one of the important factors of emphysema. The airways will collapse so that a person cannot exhale very efficiently, and air gets trapped out there. So airway patency is really the underlying feature here. In other words, is it open? If they either have a physical obstruction, such as a tumor, a plug, an infectious thing or something, or it can lose its strength so it wants to collapse. One of my favorite party features is a whoopee cushion. Does anybody know what a whoopee cushion is? Yes, sirree. A whoopee cushion is this little bladder thing, and it's got sort of a flattened out area where you blow up the whoopee cushion, right? And then you slip it under the cushion so that your friend, your sister, your wife, doesn't know it's there. And they sit down on it, and the cushion makes this real loud fart sound, right? Well, the way it does that is that the opening to it, and a balloon would do the same thing. You blow up a balloon and pull kind of a, make the end of the balloon very tight, it'll start to make noise when the air comes out. Well, what's going on is that the two walls of that are flapping together, is the way that works. And in order to, so there's obstruction effectively, and the energy that was put into inflating the balloon or inflating the whoopee cushion is now spent in making noise as it slaps around the exit, the way back out. For the air. The smallest of the airways don't have any structure within them. As you probably are aware, our trachea has cartilage rings, the bronchi have cartilage rings, their structure, they hold it open. In the case of the small airways, What holds it open is elastic tissue that radiates out from the thing. Not elastic tissue that circumferentially covers the smallest of airways, but it radiates out. So they're like guy wires that hold up a tent or hold up, you know, a canopy or something. And if you destroy those, this sucker will want to collapse on itself. And so what happens is the air that's in the alveolus that's trying to come out when you exhale causes the same flapping kind of effect. Now, you don't hear your lungs farting, you know, but it causes, as the air moves through that passage, it causes the walls to collapse. It's actually the same principle upon which our refrigerators make cold stuff, I guess. All right, so you don't have to have, the point here is you don't have to have a physical obstruction to have an obstructive process. The walls can collapse and that traps the air behind them. And that's one of the things that we'll see is important. In the case of acute change, like in asthma, it's pretty easy maybe to understand that the reaction to the process leads to constriction of the muscle and so forth, and even swelling and so forth of the airways, and that's going to narrow them. In the case of chronic injury, we're going to take a look at spend a little time here with chronic bronchitis and emphysema. Restrictive means that the lung can't move very well. And this was something quite similar, the similar process we talked about with cardiac disease. You can have heart disease. Remember we had talked about something where there was scar tissue within the heart, so it simply couldn't go through a diastolic filling phase. It was kind of trapped from within. And the same thing occurs here, that with the amount of scar tissue that we see with cigarette smokers, people who have certain industrial exposure to particulates, and all of us actually to some degree in time. You might wonder about, well, I don't really work in the limestone industry and I'm not out there digging coal and all that, so, or working on a farm where there's a lot of dust in the air at different times. You know, but sometime when the sun is coming up, like it was just a little while ago, since now we're getting up in the middle of the night, it feels like, God, isn't that awful? Getting up, again, I'm, you know, get out of bed, it's 5:30, 6, you think, God, it's really 4 in the morning, I know that. But some morning when you're crossing the street and the sun's coming up, look at the sun, don't stare at it and burn up your eyeballs, of course, but and watch a bus come up the street. You know, we had a hard winter, right? And we put a lot of salt, put a lot of sand down on the street out there. Nobody went out and picked it up again. You're just hoping a rain's going to wash it away. But plenty of that sand, that silica sand, is out there. And after you've driven over it, you've beat it into a very fine powder. And all of us who live in an urban setting get a lot of exposure to particular, like watch a bus go by and in the sun, you will see how much dust is blown up. Well, part of the cleaning mechanism, I guess, for the street is that we all inhale it and that's where it sticks. I don't know. But at any rate, we all do have considerable exposure over time to particulates that will do chronic injury, scar tissue, and so forth in the lung and lead to restriction, internal restriction. So the lung simply cannot follow the chest wall very efficiently. Chronic obstructive pulmonary disease is a huge category. It's an umbrella category that has a couple of very important things under it that I want you to know about. Okay, now when we say COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, what do we mean? Well, symptoms that last longer than 3 months, that doesn't sound like very long to me. Oops. But basically, do you have shortage, problems breathing, moving air, you cough, you bring up mucin and that sort of thing. There's restriction of air movement. That's an important factor, whether it is obstructive from bronchi being thick-walled and you got a lot of mucus in there, or whether the smallest of airways collapse, the whoopee cushion effect, when you try to exhale. The two basic divisions, emphysema, chronic bronchitis, most times it's actually a mix. About the only time we ever see absolutely pure emphysema, as I will talk about in a moment here, is in the situation of alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. People who have cigarette smoke, they do a lot of damage to their lungs, but it's always a combined chronic bronchitis and emphysema. There's upper airway disease, which is basically the obstructive, chronic bronchitis part of it, and then there's very small, called lower airway disease, that is part of the injury that goes on from the smaller particulates that lodge out there. And so in most situations, when it's environmentally related, it's always a mixture of the two. Now, in the case of emphysema, what we have will be a weakening of the wall and decrease in the amount of elastic tissue around the terminal airways. These are the last of the airways that go into that alveolar sac area. Sometimes some of them are considered respiratory bronchioles, but these terminal bronchioles, and because of the inflammation related to smoking and particulates, it will go that far and lodge out there. You end up with inflammation at that point, which means activated proteases are right there on the spot. In the case of cigarette smoke, there's junk in there that actually will limit the ability of alpha-1 antitrypsin to pick up those, so that you have kind of an added effect. I not only have more activation locally in these terminal airways right in through here, but I also neuter the ability, I reduce the ability to break down those digestive enzymes. And what happens is, although you can't see it here, there's elastic tissue that radiates out from those. So they extend out like guy wires and hold that sucker open. So when you exhale, it won't want to collapse. And it will want to collapse because there's a differential now in the pressure. Since air is moving away, moving through it, the pressure, by definition and by actual measurement, the pressure inside the airway is less than the pressure outside, or it won't go anyplace. If it's equal pressures, then no exhalation is going to occur. So what happens then is that in that situation, when you lose the elastic tissue, the terminal bronchioles will collapse. And so what the person will have, if you've seen anybody, and my guess is you probably have, you will see they have a very interesting way of breathing. First, they have a quick inspiratory phase and then a very prolonged expiratory as they exhale. And they're trying to slow down the movement of air out so that it doesn't collapse. When you run, you all go out and run. I would assume you've all done something, run for a bus, run for something, run for your life. I don't know. Some of you probably are even actually go out and run for entertainment or something. You know what I mean? If you were to tell anybody else, you know, people who are in the third world, Africa or somewhere, and say, I went out and I ran 26 miles for the fun of it, you know, you'd look like a complete jerk. I mean, people who actually work for a living don't have to go out and run for fun. But when you go out and run and you're really running, how do you breathe when you're really out there really going? You open your mouth as wide as you can to make air move. Are you doing this? Or are you breathing? Someone demonstrate. What do you do? Do we have any runners? You don't? When you're really running out of breath, go up and down the stairs about 5 times and see what you just do naturally. Okay? First off, you may keel over. That would be quite natural, I guess. But you breathe with pursed lips. You know, when you're really, you're sort of puffing. Am I the only one that does this? Is that the way you breathe? Tell me. Yes. What you're doing is, when you do that, is you're slowing down exhalation. You're creating what's called a positive end expiratory pressure. If I wanted to simply move air, I'd open my mouth as wide as I could and out it would come. But you don't want to do that, and you don't have to be taught that. You know that what you want, as you exhale, if you're really moving air fast, that's the way you breathe. Because you want to keep some positive pressure in the airway, or let me tell you, your little guys are going to collapse too. So you're keeping some positive pressure behind it by creating a diaphragm out of your lips with a smaller opening, and that creates positive pressure. Watch a person who has emphysema, they're sitting there watching television and they're breathing like this. A short inspiratory phase, pursed lips, puckered up lips while they're breathing. And what they're doing is they're creating that positive end expiratory pressure. They're doing everything they can without ever having been taught it to keep these guys open because they create pressure in the system, back pressure in it, or they will completely collapse. So you do it too. Okay, so we got a couple things going on with emphysema. One, we are actually destroying lung tissue, so you don't have the exchange area. So instead of being 100 yards of football field, you're on the 30-yard line. Okay, you're in serious trouble. Plus, because of the loss of those radiating elastic fibers, you can't hold those terminal airways open. And so not only do you have a decreased exchange area, you can't move the air efficiently. Emphysema. That is really the hallmark of emphysema. And this shows two different forms of it. I don't want you to bother with that. I want you to know the business I just talked about. And that is the pathophysiology. In essence, what it has to do with is the elastases that damage the elastic tissue that help hold those terminal airways open. And again, we're not talking about elastic tissue that wraps around stuff. There's definitely elastic tissue around the alveoli, so that it wants to squeeze it and press the air out. What you need are elastic tissue that radiates out that holds those little very thin-walled airways open. Here's an example of a honeycomb pattern that we would see with a person with emphysema, all shot full like that. Again, seeing a very pure emphysema like this with no bronchitic element to it, almost always that's somebody who had an alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. If you're a cigarette smoker, you're going to have both. Higher power view showing this very spongy appearance. Normally, if you take a look at a lung, you don't see any holes. The alveoli are so small. And then you have another problem. Once you've got air trapped in these big air spaces back there, it comes around and compresses the tissue next to it so that those little airways that should be open now get squished closed because of the trapped air from the neighboring alveoli. So there are multiple things that then change the ability to move air. This is how somebody with kind of pure line emphysema would look. If they're not exercising and doing anything, they tend to be fairly pink. They can move oxygen fairly well. What they can't do is they can't get rid of carbon dioxide. And they get progressively accustomed to carbon dioxides of 2 and 3 times what it normally should be. That's what's going to kill them in the long run, by the way. Kind of a barrel chest because of all the air that's trapped out there. They become very thin and worn because they spend so much of their energy. They can spend 6,000 calories a day breathing alone. That's it. What are you operating on, huh? Maybe 3,000 calories a day? In my case, you know, if I go to McDonald's 2 or 3 times in the course of a day, it might be a little bit more. But at any rate, you know, we're looking at somebody here who will spend almost all of their available energy on simply moving air. And so they're very thin, rapid respirations, pursed lips. This is the example of emphysema, so-called pink puffer. Now, a person who has chronic bronchitis has upper airway disease. What we've been talking about at this point is all this lower airway, all the way out in the alveoli and the terminal bronchioles. Now, chronic bronchitis is also under this obstructive, chronic obstructive label, chronic obstructive umbrella. And this is an upper airway condition. Again, it's due in almost all to cigarette smoke or some kind of industrial exposure to stuff that gets stuck there and serves as an irritant to the bronchi, segmental bronchi, these larger divisions of the airway. And the end result is lots of increase of mucus production, but also increase in the number of cells that produce the mucus. And so they have a lot. They're always coughing. You hear them get up in the morning and they'll start rattling and cough up stuff. But anyway, it's a larger airway problem. And because of the connective tissue increase and other stuff in the wall of these major divisions of the bronchi, it gets thicker, which means the lumen gets narrower, gets smaller. These people do tend to have problems moving both CO2 and oxygen, and so they may be blue. They're known as a blue bloater, and here this guy is demonstrating every aspect of it. They aren't really thin like the other one. They're always coughing up mucus and stuff like that. Chronic bronchitis, and generally speaking, these two come together, but they are under the category of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Your book does a nice job of distinguishing those two. Please read that for me. Now, here's acute constrictive problems. This would be an example of asthma. There are plenty of people in here have that. And it can be triggered by external allergens, or it can be internal sort of thing. So there are a number of different triggers for it. Stress among them. Perhaps some of you are sitting over there wheezing right now from the earlier episode this morning. There is, the hallmark is bronchoconstriction. You have smooth muscle in the airways. And part of that too is to conserve heat. If you go out and you breathe real cold air, everybody's bronchi are going to constrict. That's just part of the nature of the beast. The one thing about this is, if you don't die acutely, it is reversible. Whatever it is that triggers it, triggers the release of, if it's going to be IgE mediated, not all of it is IgE mediated, by the way, it will eventually, it'll abate. The one that's the easiest to understand is so-called extrinsic asthma, and again, I'm sure some of us have that here, related to allergen exposure. It's previous sensitization of it. It's a type 1 hypersensitivity, the IgE. Antibodies are now on the surface of basophils and mast cells and things like that, and the next time you get exposed to that allergen, it causes an excessive release of histamine. Histamine is an important inflammatory mediator. It's functioning in all of us. It has to be there. It increases blood flow to areas of injury. It increases vascular permeability, so fluid can get out, and so that you can do battle with the bacteria if they're coming across the wall or whatever it is. Histamine is an important element in our defense and reparative mechanism. What we're looking at here is something that just goes way over the top. And so IgE, it's IgE mediated. These people will also have what's called atopic changes, and that is, these are skin manifestations, typically in skin folds and cubital fossa here, other places. My view on that is, it's probably wrong, but my view on that is that it is related to allergens that get stuck on the surface of the skin and serve as a chronic irritant to the skin and get epithelial thickening and stuff like that. But at any rate, in areas such as that, we'll see thickening of the skin, it gets kind of pigmented, so-called atopic changes. So that refers to the skin changes. It's a little harder to understand intrinsic asthma. In this case, there are clearly examples of triggers, but it is not IgE mediated. So not all asthmatics have IgE, or even if you do have IgE mediated asthma, there are other things that can trigger a very severe asthmatic attack. Viral infections, and some people, we don't understand, and I don't understand entirely how it works, but aspirin will do that. But viral infections for sure in kids, again, where airways are already kind of small, it doesn't take a lot of swelling before some kid is really in a world of hurt. I mentioned cold, and again, everybody has some degree of bronchoconstriction with exposure to cold air, but this is something that goes way beyond it in the case of an asthmatic. Other things, volatiles, perfumes, things of that sort. Lilies. I hate lilies. Easter is my killer time. You know, I have to sit outside. I don't even go into. I go to church, but I sit outside and I listen on a speaker, because if I smell those lilies, I will have an asthmatic attack in a heartbeat. There are a lot of things that every now and then I'll be someplace, getting on an airplane, and God, somebody sits down beside me and they got, you know, patchouli oil or whatever. Which generally means I've been smoking dope. That's what I assume. You know what I mean? Smoking a reefer. Now we're going to hide that by putting that real stinky patchouli oil on. I mean, I'll be in a full-blown asthmatic attack by the time we get where we're going. So there are just volatile agents that can trigger that are not IgE mediated. This is the one, that part extrinsic is the one that's a little bit easier to understand. This is what's going on. Now, in the long run, this, if we think about, we're going to look now at extrinsic asthma, that there are two phases which we see, and that is the acute phase, which is mediated by the histamine release, and there's a secondary phase that can occur as much as 8 hours later, which is more neurological in nature, in which case the person comes back in the emergency room or is calling their doctor again, look, I haven't had any exposure, but I'm having just as much shortness of breath as I was before. I got better for a while, and now I'm worse. So there's typically a two-step effect here. The other thing that happens is if you have prolonged exposure here, there's going to be a lot of inflammation and scarring of that. And so if you are really an asthmatic, you need to be treated with something that's going to slow down this. Inhale steroids or a variety of things that can be done. But if you're not on some kind of anti-inflammatory or leukotriene inhibitor that breaks this cycle, you're not being treated properly. I'll just tell you right now. If all they're treating is your asthmatic symptoms, you're not being treated properly, because 10 years down the road, you're going to have a lot of scarring and a lot of permanent change in those bronchi. So this is showing what's going to happen down the road if it isn't treated properly. You're going to go with a much more thickened thing, lots of more mucin cells, chronic accumulation of collagen and so forth, even smooth muscle cell. Here's probably a better representation, which I stole straight out of your textbook, which shows kind of the normal slice out of an airway, And here we look at somebody who's had chronic asthmatic changes. They weren't treated properly. And you'll see how thickened up these areas become, how many inflammatory cells are here, the amount of collagen that's there, the great number of goblet cells, which really aren't there at all on this one. So producing a lot of mucin. And now you've got a permanent change that the odds are you will never be able to correct. Okay, I just want to finish this up and then that's it, and I'll go back and do whatever comes next in my office. This is a problem that we will see, and it's most noted in people who have chronic infections of the airway. And this is bronchiectasis, so we're moving on to something else. I want to finish this and then I'm going to quit. A bronchiectasis, you see these huge dilated bronchi right here. Often it is in the upper airways. This would be a change that can occur in anybody if they have chronic bronchitis, ongoing infections in there, but especially so in people who have cystic fibrosis. A lot of plugs, they get a lot of bronchitic infections, and these bronchi will dilate. They just become like cesspools. They're huge, they're full of mucus, they're full of bacteria, and let me tell you, if you've ever been around anybody, with cystic fibrosis and who has bronchiectasis or has bronchiectasis for a different reason, say cigarette smoking or something, you don't want to stand near them. You don't want them exhaling on you. And what you will notice is, and I'm sorry, I mean, I've been there plenty. I took care of plenty of these people when I was in school. You cannot let them breathe on you because you can't stand the smell. This is a cesspool. It's got all kinds of bacteria. And when you talk about buffalo breath, you have never smelled anybody's bad breath of this quality, this is galactic level bad breath because of all the stuff that is stewing in here. Very foul smelling, chronic, all the time infected. I don't use the term cesspool lightly. That's exactly what's going on. It's like one of these porta-johns and they forgot to put the stuff in it, you know? And you're at the beer festival and you go in that thing and you think you're going to barf because of the way it smells. That's the way they smell. These people get up in the morning and you'll hear them up and down the hall. They will start and it will be a cough, literally like it's almost tectonic plate movement, you know? And they will start, and they'll start bringing up all the garbage that has accumulated over the night while they were lying flat, if they can lie flat. Bronchiectasis. The ectasia refers to the dilatation of the bronchi, and that occurs because of repeat infections and loss of structural stuff of, again, these larger upper airway bronchi. And once they get real dilated, they can start trapping stuff, the mucus is there, and then it's a constant day in and day out, everyday chronic infection. Bronchiectasis. All right, it's in that same kind of category that we were talking about. I don't know if I consider it quite chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, but it's certainly chronic. That's where we're going to stop for now. Thank you all. Sorry I ran over a few minutes. That's life.